It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon and a warm welcome to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. I am Batya Bricker, and today we are travelling up north. The Kruger National Park has been in the news lately, and not for the reasons we would like. Torrential rain, flooded rivers, washed away roads, damage to ancient trees and fragile habitats. It's the kind of headlines that make your heart tighten, especially when the place in question is a place you love. For many of us, the Kruger, as it's lovingly known, is not just a national treasure. It's a happy place. It's a place of stillness, a respite from our busy lives. It's the long trip up north. It's the putt course. It's the playlists. The July school holidays circled on the calendar months before. It's early morning game drives wrapped in blankets with a large assortment of snacks to hand that are usually open. And now, as they begin to recover from the devastating floods, as the rivers recede, as the roads are repaired, and as plants push green shoots back through the battered soil, as they heal and rebuild, I wanted to send some bookish love to the people, plants, and animals in recovery. Today's show is a bookish ode to the Kruger. Sunrises, sightings, skottles, braais, and buckies. So grab your binoculars and let's head to the bush and the books. But first, let me ask you, do you have a marvelous memory from the Kruger? One of those family-making moments that you will remember forever? Please share it with me on the SMS line 061-895-1019. The first book we're delving into is called 101 Kruger Tales by Jeff Gordon, and it's a collection of gripping first-hand accounts of extraordinary sightings, scrapes, and incidents in one of Africa's greatest national parks, the Kruger. I was amazed that this book was published actually close on 10 years ago, but still sells in such high quantities. So it's considered a perennial bestseller, which is brilliant in the South African publishing market. So, you know, all those stories that we tell around the Shabbos tables or Sunday lunches. An enraged elephant flips a car onto its roof. A lioness prizes open the door of a terrified couple. A fleeing impala leaps through an open car door. A tourist takes a bath in a croc-infested dam. And one of my favorite stories in this book is about a leopard who helps herself to a family picnic breakfast from the skottle braai. All the visitors at the Afsal picnic spot, which you may know is unfenced, they watch aghast, hiding behind their cars and other braais, and watch the leopard enjoying the bacon and eggs, no doubt, and then sauntering off cool as a cucumber when she had had her fill. So these are just some of the 101 jaw-dropping sightings, scrapes, and encounters in this collection of extraordinary true stories from the roads, camps, picnic sites, and walking trails of South Africa's Kruger National Park, from the people who really experience them. So these are not game ranger tales. Each and every one happened to an ordinary Kruger visitor like you and me, doing what over a million tourists do in this spectacular reserve every year. So it isn't the kind of book to read in one go, as each story needs a moment to stand alone and to sink in, and to really kind of get a sense of how amazing this close encounter is. The only trouble is that it makes you want to visit the Kruger, which is great on one hand, but rather difficult on the other, because July is still a way to go. But this is a bedside book. It's a travel companion. It's a dip into Read Anywhere compilation of joyful encounters. Jeff Gordon the author or compiler, should I say, is one of the myriad ordinary Kruger visitors with no special affiliation to the park, but he happens to enjoy a good yarn. And so that is what started this book. He invited Kruger visitors to submit stories about their experiences, and he was flooded with stories. It proved popular beyond any imagining, and he is working on the second. He says he likes his boerewors a touch underdone, his biltong thinly sliced, and his amarula on ice. And I wanted to just read you the dedication in the beginning because I found it so moving. He says, to that dying breed of Kruger visitor, the one who still drives slowly, still raises a finger of greeting to every oncoming car, and still stops to share with barely concealed delight what you may find in the shade of an umbrella thorn tree just a few kilometers down the road. What is your forever Kruger memory, that family moment you still talk about it? Share it with me on the SMS line 061-895-1019.
High FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
The next book to chat about is called The Buck That Buries Its Poo and 101 Fascinating Facts About South African Wildlife. It's written by Quentin Kutsia. And this book has sold also an incredible amount of copies and continues to top the charts. And I think that it's going to be one of those 101 tales from Kruger or Kruger tales that's just going to keep selling and selling. Is a zebra black with white stripes or white with black stripes? Why do flamingos stand on one leg? Why do bats hang upside down? Do you know that a chameleon's tongue can shoot out at 5 times the acceleration of a fighter jet? My boys love that one. Are dassies and elephants really related? And can elephants jump? No, they can't, by the way. They always keep one foot on the ground, even when they walk. But the questions are as entertaining as the answers. In The Buck That Buried Its Poo, naturalist Quentin Kutsia does what he does is explore each question and provides answers to these and other many intriguing wildlife questions. He also dispels myths and elucidates some of the legends that surround creatures in the South African bush we thought we knew about. For example, he says that bats actually don't get tangled up in people's hair, although I have to tell you that when I was young, a teenager, this did happen to me. I did have a bat fly into my head, but she didn't get tangled. Apparently, they are far too adept at flying to get tangled in hair. And elephants are not afraid of mice, but they do fear bees. Other tall tales you might hear around the campfire are that lions roll in animal dung, that rhinos like to stamp out fires. But what is true is that hyenas are more closely related to cats than to dogs. That is something I really didn't know. I'll read you a little bit about the aardvark, which I enjoyed. He asks, is an aardvark a pig? Aardvark is the Afrikaans word that means earth pig when translated literally. But in English, this animal is also called an ant bear. But an aardvark is neither a pig nor a bear, and it's not an anteater either. The aardvark looks somewhat like a chimera. It has a snout like a pig, ears like a rabbit, and what looks like the tail of a kangaroo. But it's not related to any of these creatures. So where does the aardvark fit amongst the mammals of the mammal kingdom? Scientists have thought they might be related to the South American anteaters, or to pangolins, or armadillos, but none of these seemed like a good fit. So in the end, aardvark got a special place in the taxonomic puzzle, an own order and its own genus. They are unique in this regard, and they are the sole order of animals that has an only single representative. So that gives you a feel. This really is a dip in and dip out kind of book. It is so brilliant for younger readers, and I think especially for reluctant readers, people who don't really consider themselves reading, if you want to get them reading, the facts are fascinating, the questions even more so. And they're in sort of little light, easy bite-sized pieces, so it's not long pieces to read. It's based on All the information here is based on Coetzee's own research and that of others, and his decades of experience gleaned by living close to nature and wildlife. One of my favorite parts of the book was his section at the end on collective nouns for animals. So this is a favorite for word nerds. Things like a flamboyance of flamingos, or a camouflage of chameleons, an intrusion of cockroaches. I'm just paging through more. This is fun. A scurry of tree squirrels. And of course, the pack of wild dogs or a herd of wildebeest. But then there's the dazzle of zebra, which I do love. Having spent so much time in the wild, Quinton says, with people of all ages from different backgrounds, he was struck by the realization that their interests, conversations, and questions about nature were often about the same things. Whether professional naturalists or safari guides, nature-loving adults and wide-eyed children, our curiosity about the fascinating world of nature has no bounds, and this book captures it. Oh, and by the way, zebras are black with white stripes. And now for a real treat. We are traveling down to the Karoo and then back up again to the Kruger with the author Sally Andrew, who wrote the Tani Maria series of books, you may know, Recipes for Love and Murder. We caught up with her on her stoop in the Karoo and spoke about Tani Maria's travels to the Kruger and other marvelous antics. And be sure to listen to the birds tweeting in the background of this very marvelous interview. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark.
Turn the page. It's the Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home of stories and the people who love them. Today, I'm joined by the utterly delightful Sally Andrew, creator of the beloved culinary agony aunt turned crime fighter Tani Maria. Sally, a very warm welcome.
Batya, I'm so happy to be with you again and so happy to be chatting on your radio show.
And we're just delighted to have caught you when you have Wi-Fi, but we'll talk more about that later because where you live is rather exotic to us suburban types, but also, evocative of everything you write about. Sally is the author of what is now an iconic and much-loved Tani Maria series. And if you haven't yet tried this wonderfully delicious cozy crime series set in the Karoo, you still have time to catch up on the previous tales before book number 5 or book number 6, if we're going to count the cookbook, hits the shelves later this year. So by way of introduction, Tani Maria first appeared in Recipes for Love and Murder as an agony aunt in a small South African town in the Little Karoo. Tani Maria is an obsessed foodie and recipe writer for the local newspaper. And then the newspaper decides to do away with the recipe column. And Tani Maria keeps her apron on, but becomes a very special kind of agony aunt. And every problem is solved with a recipe. The Tani Maria books are packed with wholesome local recipes and comfort food that you can really cook and bake. And there's an amazing story to boot from cover to cover. Meanwhile, the books are of the cozy crime variety, my very favorite. There's always a murder in town, a mystery to solve, and someone with criminal intent, usually directed at our hero, Tani Maria, who inadvertently finds herself at the heart of the town crime scene. The books, you will no doubt know some of these, Recipes for Love and Murder, The Satanic Mechanic, Death on the Limpopo, and the Milk Tart Murders. But before we go anywhere near a crime scene, Sally, if you had to describe Tani Maria, how would you do that?
That was such a wonderful introduction, Batya. When you're immersed in something, you kind of find it hard to summarize it as sweetly as you do. So Tani Maria is, how did I describe her? 50-something, short and soft, but not always in the right places. But who gets to define what places are right? So I'd say she's intrepid. She's very human. She's always learning and always growing. Each of the books is a great journey for me because she's developing psychologically. And she's quite frightened to start off with. She's come out of an abusive relationship. But she is brave because one can only develop bravery if you are fear. And she just goes ahead and does it anyway. And together with Jessie, her sort of sidekick, although she's not really a sidekick, she's an investigative journalist in herself, and Hattie, also from the Clan Carew Gazette, they take on murderers and they bring them down. And in between, she does a lot of cooking and baking, but she's got a little bit of left field humor. She's in some ways, she's a very grounded Afrikaans Tannie, but she's also got a left-wing father who died when she was quite young, which we'll explore a bit more in Death on the Limpopo. So she's an interesting combination of that kind of Afrikaans groundedness and a little bit of English left-wing, but this very unique, wise, comforting, kind agony aunt and sleuth. Interesting combination. And cook and lover. A lot of the books are about her love relationships.
I'm afraid
I'm not giving a short summary.
I love the developing relationship with Hank, with the chestnut moustaches, and you really can picture Detective Kanamea. It has a charm, and it's human, and it's vulnerable, and it's. Oh, I think anyone who's had a romantic relationship and tentatively dipped their toes into love can relate. How much of you lives in her, Sally?
I think a word is, maybe just to say one more word about her, is tender. Yes. I know with Maria Doyle Kennedy, who plays her in the Recipes for Love and Murder TV series, she said what brought her in was the tenderness, that there's so many gory murder mysteries, but she's a tender character and the stories are always tender.
Well, I think that comes from you, Sally.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of what overlaps, yes, we do have overlapping tenderness. I'm a little bit more off the wall than her.
Yes.
The main thing that we share is the Clan Carew and our love of the Clan Carew. So as I'm sitting now on a stoop of my neighbour looking at this exquisite kloof with the waterfalls, we've just had rain and thunder and hailstorms and the birds are singing and the trees are alive. There's this level of kind of psychedelic bliss that we've fallen into after a number of quite intense thunderstorms. And this love of the Carew, the love of the Gwari trees, the love of the birds, the love of the insects, the creatures, the open land, the small town people, that is where Tani, Maria and I overlap. And that's the real world that we share in terms of the Clan Carew. She lives just on the other side of Ladysmith. I'm on the Barriedale side of Ladysmith on a nature reserve. So that's our main overlap. And our differences are, I'm not a cook, she is, although she's been teaching me to cook. We have overlapping psychological journeys. So whenever I plan a book, I look at what am I wanting to work through. So for example, if I'm working with jealousy in my own life, I'll make it a theme for her. But we're overlapping in that we're on journeys towards healing. But we are very different people, and I think it's important to keep your especially your first-person character, distinctly different from you. Oh, we're also both 50-something, although I've now overtaken her. It's not far till I'm 60, but she's a little bit earlier in her 50s. So we do have some overlapping, but she's very much a small-town Tani, whereas although I've moved to a small town, I'm a bit more of a city girl, and I'm more English than her. And I do feel her as quite separate from me. She teaches me, and I throw her into all sorts of wild and wonderful situations that she might not have considered before, like dragging her up to Limpopo or throwing her into wild things. I take her to Sanborna Nature Reserve. So I give her an adventurous life, and she teaches me to be grounded and kind and to cook.
And to cook, I'm sure you've become a better cook since you met Tani Maria, just in terms of trying new things and experimenting with food, perhaps that you didn't in the past.
Totally. But I don't know if I've told you, but Tani Maria, she's this fictional character and she has just won two international Gourmand Awards.
Oh, how fantastic.
222 countries competing. And she won not only the one best of the year in her category, then there was another award, which I didn't even know existed. I just got this email. They selected the book as the best of the best, they call it, the best over the last 30 years in its category of acknowledgements. So it's so crazy to me that this fictional character is competing with real cooks and chefs around the world and coming home with these incredible Gourmand Awards. It's just so crazy.
So fantastic. And yeah, indicative of the kind of crazy world that we do live in. So congrats to you.
But I must also just tell you, in terms of blowing the horn of the Clay and Carew and this book, part of why the book won is it's full of these photos of the Clay and Carew, as well as the food, as well as Tani Maria's wise sayings, and the letters that she writes as an agony aunt. So they're also in the cookbook. So it really is a beautiful book. If you haven't seen it yet, check it out.
You started, for me, the kind of first recipe was the Venus cake. Please talk about the Venus cake.
That's actually on the cover of the cookbook, the heart-shaped version. It's a buttermilk, very tender chocolate buttermilk cake. It took many sessions of practice. I roped in a slightly OCD at that stage. She was slightly OCD cooking obsessed teenager, and she did about 10 tests on it until she was thrown out of her house and had to go test next door, because we wanted to get the consistency of the sponge cake just right. So it's this chocolate buttermilk cake with this coffee chocolate ganache with peanut butter and apricot jam in the middle. It's just all Tani Maria and my favorite things put together. And it's called the Venus cake because it's out of this world, and because Venus is the goddess of love, and the cake is used for various purposes related to love, which you'll have to read some of the letters about. But it really is too divine. I think it's one of the – I sort of, once I'd invented that, I feel okay. I can die happy. But then there were more things to do.
It's definitely a kind of last meal kind of thing to choose, a slice of Venus cake. But the cake is, it's not about the batter, and it's not about just the food. It really is about soul food, and it's about healing that comes through food. And that comes from your background as well, right?
Yeah, so I have had an interest in healing of various sorts. I did study psychology for a while. And then I was extremely ill with ME. I was wiped out. I couldn't even brush my hair. And now I can do park runs. So I've been on a long journey of healing. And I do healing work myself with tuning forks, sound healing. So it has been a long interest for me. And I'm always on my own journey. And sometimes, you know, and that's why I say Tani Maria and I overlap a little bit.
Tani Maria and you both share, as you said, the Clan Karua. That is a shared passion and interest. And in many ways, it isn't just a backdrop. It's actually almost a character, I think, the Karu in your novel. So. Tell us about your writing space, Salsa Hook, and what do you hear from your desk? And I've seen a picture of it, and it looks almost out of a picture book, fantasy picture book.
Yeah, no, it is. I live in a parallel reality, where not only the physical nature around me is so beautiful, but my partner Bowen is an artist, and he and Tasi Machil and other helpers sculpted. So there's a few buildings there, but one of them is my sculpted Salsa Hook, which is inside. It's curved like the belly of a whale. And it's got these ribs, curved ribs. And there's birds that nest in there and have hatched in there. And it's the shape of the Fibonacci ratio. It's got amazing sound acoustics. And I sit at the desk there and I look up onto the Tosberg Mountains with sort of green and orange lichen. And the birds, now again, I'm on my neighbor's stoop, but the birds landed just in front of me. Another one. They all want to be part of the interview.
Maybe
welcome. You pick them up. There's some of their sounds in the recording. And I hear the birds singing from where I work. And there's a little dam next door, and the frogs are singing from there as well. So it really is an idyllic place to write from. And things will literally, so as I'll write my acknowledgements, for example, a little mongoose, hello, another two bulbuls. I think my neighbor usually Maybe she feeds them, perhaps.
You might be very disappointing, like Sally, to these bulbuls. They might not be very happy with you.
They're going to start pecking me to death. do you just get to know and listen and hear the birds? I mean, we, for example, we built a nest for the swifts, and they, when the baboons broke it down, they came into our bedroom, landed on a mosquito nest, and wouldn't leave the room until I said, oh my gosh, the baboon's broken their nest, we must build another. They flew out, we built a nest. They're quite shy birds, but eight of them, after I'd built it, they flew right around me, like I could almost touch them, to say thank you. We have another, when you can tune in, let go of your crazy brain and your worries and anxieties, which consumes most of the space, let go of the busy pace. Just the connection to nature is so easy and so welcome, and it feels magical just because it's unusual, but that this is actually real life. So we'll get onto this because of the theme in my next book, Connection, Wild Things Never Die. We are part of nature. We are nature.
Beautiful.
So I am in nature and of nature when I write, and it sort of moves through me. And sometimes things happen to me that then I put into a book, like, for example, Maria, in one of the books, she copies something that I experienced. It was a bird singing this such a beautiful medley. I actually think it one that might have hatched in my own writing room. It sang me such a beautiful medley that I couldn't bear it. I just went inside. It just broke my heart. It was too beautiful. And then I realized I didn't feel worthy of such beauty. And I had a similar scene with Tani Marie in one of the books where she didn't feel worthy. And then later in the book, she could hear it. And it's also been a process for me to receive this, that it's like, who am I to receive such beauty? But who am I not to? Who am I to reject it? Who am I to block it?
Oh, very fortunate. Very fortunate.
So, but we all have that. But when you're living surrounded by nature, it's easier to connect. But it's the same wherever we go. There's always sunsets and sunrises. There's always the option to connect or disconnect. There's always the option to obsess with our own self-criticism or to be in life. And Tani Marie and I are both learning to be more in life and less caught up in our dramas. Apart from important dramas like catching murderers and baking cakes, of course.
I think that's the work of all of us, to be less in our heads and sort of, well, yes. Well, if we can get proverbial here. Most certainly not about the cake, but hopefully about the murderers. Today, because the show is a bookish ode to the Kruger, we are traveling north beyond the dusty embrace of your beloved Klein Karoo, past the long highways and thorn trees, all the way to the edges of the third book in the series, Death on the Limpopo. And I want to know why you took Tani Maria on this road trip, and what did the setting, this different setting, allow you to explore that the Karoo couldn't offer?
Well, one of the reasons is that we love to go up there. My partner, Bowen, kind of grew up under a mashatu tree in that area, and we go up there regularly. So I wanted to take Tani Maria to one of my favorite spots and make my holidays tax deductible. And to go even deeper into the wilds, because the Karoo is ancient Africa, but the whole area where we go to near the, in the Thule block, the border of Botswana, South Africa, Zimbabwe, we go into Botswana, is really like ancient Africa, those giant trees. But it also just took Tani Maria out of her comfort zone, and she traveled with Zaba from the Daily Maverick, who was on her own adventure, and it took her to a story from her past, because her father, as an ANC member, I must be careful, I don't want to do any major spoilers, but he was active in that area. So it took her on a journey to do with her relationship with her father, which also opened her up in her relationship with Henk, and gave her a very wild adventure, very much out of her comfort zone. But Zabanguni, who usually drives a black Ducati, was now in Tani Maria's little pickup and was able to help Maria through this very unfamiliar and dangerous area, not just psychologically but physically. And they had all sorts of adventures with crocodiles and baobab trees and being shot at and drones, and so they really did do a nice travel across the country. And it was just also lovely to celebrate the whole country as they moved through it, as well as getting to those really wild places with the big trees and encounters with elephants.
Is she going to travel again?
I'm wondering. I mean, now that she's won this international award,
she could go to Paris.
I got to go to Portugal to receive one of them, but marvelous. She didn't. So I do wonder. And then she does travel in book five. I take her out of the little Ladysmith town to what was actually based on Sanborna, but I call the Karoo Wilderness Reserve, which is a private conservation, but one of the biggest private game reserves in the country, which is Karoo, but also wild. So it's also got rhinos and elephants and cheetahs and leopards, etc. So that's an interesting combination where I've got the really wild in the Karoo. So I do move her there to a fancy game lodge with her hen. We'll get onto a bit more of that later, perhaps. But I'm kind of advised that as a cozy mystery writer, which I didn't even know the term till I started it, writing it, was that you do need to kind of stay a bit in a similar area with the same characters. You can travel now and again, but you've got to keep returning to base. So I don't know. I don't have plans for further travel. I think next one we'll have her back in Ladysmith.
Well, I think the book Death on the Limpopo is the one that's set near the Kruger National Park, near the
yes.
Kruger. And it certainly feels different to her usual milieu. It's also a novel that engages... Yes, it's much more about contemporary political issues. It feels a little bit grittier, would you say?
It wasn't that it engaged directly with something going on, which I sort of try not to do. Although I did mention Mandela's death in the first book. It was so the main character, Zabangula, was dealing a lot with the corruption, which has continued, but at the time of writing was most extreme, perhaps. So it was engaging with that. But usually there's a kind of political or environmental or some sort of social theme running through the books as well. So there might be fracking in one. In book five, it's anti-poaching. In others, it's dealing with PTSD is book two. Book three, that's the death on the Limpopo, dealing with corruption. And it does kind of interweave the past and the present as well in the politics of the story. Book four, I deal more with eating disorders. So there's usually a kind of gritty theme weaving through all of the books, but that one was most directly related to the current politics.
Can you share what you're going to tackle in book five?
So book five's already out. I mean, not out, it's written.
Okay.
So that's going to come out in May, and that's called Wild Things Never Die, and that's set in the Karoo Wilderness Reserve. And the main issue I'm tackling there is the poaching of succulents, which many people are not aware of, but they're literally millions of plants being stolen and a whole species being wiped out, and it's extinct of little fed plankies. So a lot of the plants are endemic and they only grow on that kopje, and the poachers will come in and remove every single one, maybe for part of the reason of making it more rare. So this has been happening a lot, and it's spread to the Clan Karoo, and it's a very shocking theme for me. And in some ways, I try to stay away with things that are too difficult for me because it's too distressing, unless there's some solutions. So I invented a symposium as well that takes place on the Karoo Wilderness Reserve that journalist Jesse is part of. And so the symposium solves the international problem of poaching and comes with international solutions. Some of them quite viable and already happening, some of them quite out there, but still that hopefully will happen. And they'll hopefully, even if they're not all the right solutions, they'll trigger debate. And the process did trigger debate. I engaged with a lot of environmental organizations in the process, asking them what they thought was possible. And also the Botanical Society wrote a leaflet around what we can do and included that in the book. But again, it's sort of woven in as a background theme because there's still a major murder or two. And the Tani Maria and Henk and Maria's hen, Henrietta, who's suffering from PTSD from her experience with the jackal in the previous book, all are undercover at this luxury game lodge. And the hen goes through quite her own major hero's journey arc of recovery. And encounters with lions and dogs. And so the hen's got its own journey, but there's two murders. There's a murderer. There's this undercover spying on the guests, who one of whom probably stole Stellae Luna, a succulent plant that I invented. And then there are these poachers, criminals, armed criminals who are breaking into the reserve and running gun battles with them as well, that Hank and Maria end up being involved in as well. So there's quite a lot of action, although the books are always pretty slow paced as well. There's a lot of contemplation and there's a lot of exploring of the theme of connection rather than control that I touched on quite a lot earlier, because that's something very close to my heart, is how do we connect? How do we know we are part of nature? And that theme goes right throughout the book. We've got a couple of amazing characters, other guests at the lodge, one of whom is this Sangoma, who gives these great speeches around connection, and then a shaman from Peru, and then this Couturier Raymond and the Baroness, German Baroness, who give fashion advice to Maria and Hank, gets foisted upon them. But they tolerate it all because they've got to carry on spying on the guests. So there's quite a lot of new threads combined with the old threads of Hank and Maria's relationship. She's a bit reluctant to set a date for a wedding, although he did propose in the previous book. And we've still got the same characters, Jessie. We've still got the letters that Tani Maria's writing, that people are writing in with their problems, and she's giving solutions and recipes as part of that. And even in the engaging throughout the big dramas, even with the prospective murderers and Maria's life being endangered, she'll be interspersed with sort of recipes and things that have been cooked. So the food is still throughout the book.
Oh, Sally, I cannot wait. I'm actually salivating. And you can be sure that the new book, I have not yet read it, but now I'm going to be on your publisher, because now I want a copy for myself to get a sense. You know that the Tani Maria books will be, it sounds like, full of action. Certainly some quirkiness if a hen is going through a soul journey. Comfort, connection, confession. It's and most certainly a little bit of Sally Andrews' inimitable quirkiness. You know, I met Sally Andrew at an Exclusive Books Managers Conference formal dinner, and not only did she pair a glamorous cocktail dress with red felskuna, she also let her hair down and showed us a couple of dance moves and shared some esoteric secrets of the bush. And I believe you've also even dressed up as Marilyn Monroe, looking like Marilyn Monroe from Some Like It Hot, which was part of the book launch, I think, Multart Murders, if I remember correctly.
Yes, Marilyn was a big character.
She was a big character. Book, yeah. And so you do get snippets of the larger-than-life character that is Sally Andrew amidst the charm and warmth and tenderness of Tani Maria. Sally, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your morning on the stoop. How glorious. And if you haven't yet met Tani Maria, I promise you she is waiting with a wooden spoon in one hand and a clue in the other. Get your hands on a copy. Thank you, Sally.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
And welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. I hope if you were listening carefully, you would have heard the birds in the background of Sally Andrew's interview. And so I must turn to the twitchers. It's time for the twitchers. The twitchers are the paparazzi of birding. They are obsessed with sightings. They are slightly sleep deprived. They are capable of identifying a bird from half a chirp and a flick of a tail. If you are one, or like me, you're merely an enthusiastic amateur, anyone who's ever heard a call in the trees and wondered, who's that? Please read on, because birding is booming. Around the world, birdwatching has exploded from a niche pastime into a mainstream outdoor activity, especially since the pandemic, when people started seeking slower, nature-centered hobbies that reconnect them with the world outside. And enthusiasm is not just rising amongst traditional enthusiasts, but also amongst a younger, tech-savvy observer who shares sightings on social media, uses apps to identify birdsong, and logs sightings as part of what is now called citizen science. And I actually came across an article earlier this week that spoke about bird brain and the effect of bird watching on cognitive ability. And they've noted that expert bird watchers have more dense area in their brain content that shows a kind of deeper understanding, better for spatial awareness, memory, etc. So birding is actually good for you. Birdwatching tourism is a sector closely tied to the hobby, and it's now considered one of the fastest growing segments of nature-based travel, with participation climbing in many countries and contributing billions to local economies. In a place like the Kruger National Park, the Big Five may get the headlines, but it's the birds that provide the soundtrack. And I have to say that since I started looking out for birds, it has completely transformed my experience of the Kruger and other safari experiences, because you're not so obsessed with seeing the biggies and you are constantly delighted by catching the smalls. The flash of a lilac-breasted roller looking like it flew out of a paint box, or the chatter of a hornbill hopping around your campsite. There's nothing like it. So birding books are all the rage. And I met up with Belinda van der Merwe from Strake Nature Publishing, and she told me all about the best-selling book in the birding category is the Sasol Birds. It's the top-selling bird book, and it has sold more than 200,000 copies since its publication, which is staggering if you think a bestseller in South Africa is considered. If you sell 5,000 copies, that would be a bestseller. So 200,000 copies is quite something. It's available in 5 editions in English and Afrikaans, and it's highly regarded. There's an expert team of authors, high-quality illustrations, showing different plumages where relevant, if it's male or female or juvenile or in flight. The calls feature has been well received, and it's now in its 5th edition. So it's kept up to date with new species, splits and lumps, and species distribution. Now, if you have spent time with a serious birder, the binocular-wearing, dawn-rising, list-guarding kind, you may have heard the slightly dramatic phrase, "Oh no, they've split it." I will tell you more about what split and lump means after the break.
High FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I hope I whet your appetite before the break about splits and lumps. Well, dear listeners, this is not about gym routines or unfortunate porridge. In the world of nature and taxonomy, there's the science of naming and classifying things. Scientists are constantly reviewing the evidence, and new DNA studies come out. Someone records a different bird song. A population behaves slightly differently in one corner of the world. And then suddenly, what we thought was one species might actually be two. Hence, a split. A split when one species becomes two, which means, and this is where birders get very animated, you may have technically seen a brand new species without leaving your garden. Your life list grows while you're making tea. A lump, however, is different. That's when two species gets folded back into one, and suddenly that rare tick you drove 6 hours for is no longer a separate species. It's been absorbed, quietly erased. And birding, it turns out, is not just about spotting birds. It's also keeping up with the drama of science. And it means that your field guide from 1998 is definitely outdated. So it's certainly time for you to stock up on some birding books. Just two birding books that I wanted to mention that I thought are so worth having on your shelf. The one is Newman's Birds by Colour, and it's organized by colour. So you spot a yellow bird with an orange tail, and you can look up yellow bird with orange tail. It's very amateur friendly and really a fantastic companion. My only complaint is that it is rather heavy, so quite difficult to schlep along when you're taking on a trip. and the other is Fancy's Bird Book. It's a fully fledged field guide for kids. And I may not be a kid, but I use this bird book all the time. It is so very easy. You have your classics and your favorites that you go to all the time. And then it classifies it in very simple terms, like your swimmers, your waders, your sleepers, your raptors, your walkers. And you almost always find the bird that you're looking for. So I hope you have enjoyed today's show. We sent some bookish love to the people, plants, and animals of the beloved Kruger National Park. Join me next week for a non-fiction episode on some of the amazing and inspiring South African stories, real South African stories, from the Julie Carr to Time Bank. And then for the star of the show, the story of 702, we'll be chatting to radio veteran David Williams about the newly released project and this book that took 12 years to put together, that is finally on the shelves, on the history of an iconic radio station that brought talk radio to South Africa. So for now, Purim Sameach, Shabbat Shalom, and happy reading.